us through the Iowa story.
Thank you, Mark. This is Lonnie. I appreciate you, by the way, reminding us about the state, the semiannual report. I'd forgotten all about it. in any event, we do have a PowerPoint presentation, and I want to some background. Our project was decreasing the amount of time that it takes for our licensure bureau to create site visits for relicensure applications. About several years ago, our licensure bureau had three surveyors who would visit agencies at least 60 days prior to the expiration of their licenses. One of the surveyors retired, and at that time, it took both of the remaining surveyors 100% of their time to meet that benchmark. So over the course of that, one of the surveyors, there were weather issues, some illness. At that point, the licensure survey team got over 150 days tardy in getting to their licensure reinspection visits. So when the change team met, I met with the licensure bureau and two other people from the Bureau of Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment, of which I'm a part. And in the course of that, it was decided that 153 days was the actual post-license expiration. The goal would be to get that back to 60 days so that each agency that was getting relicensed would get inspected 60 days prior to the expiration of their license. The main reason for that is of course, so that when the licensure inspection took place, the licensure team could then report to the State Board of Health on the inspection, and the Board of Health could approve their license going forward. In our PowerPoint presentation, I put together a flow chart of that process. And for those of you who have it open, you can see that the first part of the process, the first line, takes 2 weeks from the time the support staff tracked that an agency needed a reinspection until the agency received a paper packet with their reinspection application. Then it took up to 30 days for the agency to get the information back to us. And then it extended time if the agency didn't include all of the information it needed. So that process could go on and on until the agency got everything up to date. So this process could take, ideally would take 3 to 4 months, could take upwards of 6 months. So with the backlog that had grown through retirement and illness, they were really getting bogged down and were looking for ways to get caught back up. They initially brought back the reviewer who had retired to get things caught up, and that happened in several months. It still took several months to get caught back up. But since that time, the surveyors have continued to get bogged down and still have to devote 100% of their time to the relicensure process. On the sixth slide of our presentation, we have some results that have come in since they've been devoting all their time to that process. And they're currently getting to the agency about 37 days prior to licensure expiration. What that means is that they get to the agency, they're missing their target by 22 days. The effect of that is to back up the agency's sort of presentation of the licensure inspection to the Board of Health by several weeks, which means their license could be held up. Now, nothing happens with that license at a state level, but if it gets held up, the relicensure, then it affects their third party, can affect their third party reimbursement. It can affect several of the sorts of payment systems that they have. So it has an impact on the agencies. There were also some impacts for the Department of Public Health, and one of those is that over time, if you can follow that flow chart, it's pretty packed in there, but basically, over time, the Bureau of Licensure became responsible for generating all the paperwork that the agencies needed to use to get relicensed. They also became responsible for reminding agencies that they had been licensed, that they were up for relicensure inspection, rather. Then they then had to send out the packets, the letters, and all that had to be certified to get it to the agencies, and still does. Because of that, then the licensure surveyors, along with staff, aren't able to do other things that the licensure bureau typically does around creating data and making sure that everything that they're doing is up to date. They weren't able to do any TA, any technical assistance to agencies in any depth. They, of course, were answering emails and phone calls, but the kinds of formal things that they typically did, they can't do anymore. So the paperwork process is pretty labor-intensive, and it's dependent on that licensure staff to meet all their deadlines. And that's the thing that really got addressed in the as we went forward. The support staff was managing the paper flow. So the impact of that was that the agency, the bureau, rather, is still behind. And they are doing better at it, but what we wanted to do is move on with a new project so that they don't have to spend all their time doing things that they really could be better spending their time with. So this is really a project in process. The next step is actually, I think, the next logical step that they came up with was for the Bureau to meet with information management to be able to erase that first 2 weeks of the flow chart, to get rid of the paperwork packets. Information management has created a website which will be active May 1st, allowing the agencies to download the relicensure packets directly from the internet. They still will have to send the packets into the Bureau. The Bureau will still have to go through the packets and make sure everything's there, and then the paperwork will flow back to the agency if anything's needed. So it's still fairly labor-intensive. The next step, though, which is, I think, the next logical step, is for the Bureau to create a website where everything is automated, electronic. And they're moving towards developing that web-based application, which will completely eliminate the paper-based system. Hopefully that'll be implemented by July 1st of 2010. So that whole process should be shortened by anywhere from 30 to 40 days, leaving just the time for the agencies to complete their application. It should free up our Bureau of Licensure to do all kinds of technical assistance and the kinds of things that they really would rather be spending their time on, as opposed to traveling all over the state doing the relicensure inspection visits. So as you can see, it's still in process. And what struck me about this whole thing was it really was nice to be able to work back and forth with the Bureau of Substance Abuse Prevention and Licensure, and worked pretty easily with each other. And that's one of the places that we're working on changing in state government here. The direct impact on the agencies, I think, is around there's a credibility issue. I mean, now we've got, we're developing a different relationship with them because they know that we're really working hard to make sure that they're able to fulfill all their requirements in terms of licensure and certification. It's become more of a team effort than it ever has been in the past. So that's pretty much where we're at. Any questions about that? I flew through it. Am I early?
2-minute warning is right now, so that's right
on. Oh, well, that's... Oh, all right. Gosh, it felt like I was, like, talking a mile a minute. Okay, well... So we want to eliminate anywhere from 30 to 40 days out of this process. I think it's going to happen shortly. Excellent. Well, thank you, everybody.
So, Lonnie, I actually have a question if
yep.
nobody else has come up with
sure.
it. So it sounds like the assumption is there that the inspectors will have, you know, more time freed up to do their, you know, additional technical assistance in other activities. Is that sort
right.
of being tracked? Are you trying to measure that so that you have a
yeah.
justification on that? Or?
Yeah, well, the licensure staff is tracking the wait times, and they actually track the date that the licensure reinspection is supposed to happen. They track the date that it actually happens, and then they're creating, then they have a 60-day prior to expiration target date. So they're going to continue tracking that, and they're going to track that all the way through implementation of the new systems to make sure that it's changing. And in the meantime, we'll be tracking that and reporting on that.
Lonnie, I have a question, too. When did you start this?
Oh, it was a long time ago. it was in May.
Part of it. It's a great, great, you know, where you're going is going to be, you know, wonderful for the agency.
Well, yeah, it was in, let me stop and think, May of... We did a baseline. The baseline ran from May of 2007 to May of 2008. And then we had the change team meeting in May, June, July of 2008. And then we had two other change team meetings. And it was the last time I met with them would just be a few weeks ago. So it's been about a year and a half. It's so slow. You know, but it will be, you know, the payoff, I think, will be great. And it's about in line with how long things take.
Yeah.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Great. Any last comments or questions for Lonnie? All right. Great. Great. Appreciate that, Iowa. Great work. Okay. Well, then let's... Michelle, are you ready at the bat?
I'm ready.
All right. Let's hear about Oklahoma's work.
All right. Well, we were doing a statewide project to try and improve access to treatment. The change leader actually on this project was David Harris. He's joined our team. He's actually a transformation agent in this agency and has started working with TI to see if we can do a whole lot more spread in our agency and across our state with this. So he's been a real joy to work with, and we're getting a lot of different personalities in here doing change. We've been really excited about that. The first thing that we did is understand and involve the customer. Each year, we meet with our providers, I'm sure a lot of you do, and we identify state-level barriers to their being able to improve treatment access and retention. So obviously the question is, what is it that we do as a state payer that might be creating barriers that keep people from getting into treatment with you? And definitely one of the most heard concerns when we did this a year or so, got about a year and a half ago, were that there was more need for ASAM and ASI training. That was one of the top barriers. We require, our contracts require that substance abuse treatment professionals are trained on the Addiction Severity Index and the ASAM before they're allowed to assess clients. So if you get a new staff person in and you want them to do assessments, they can't do that until they receive this training from the department and become certified to do ASAM and ASI training. So needless to say, if we're not kind of on our game and doing things on a timely basis, then we can really create a barrier there. And in fact, for the last year, we have been creating a huge barrier for people to get in. So that's kind of what we took on as our aim. We decided we would increase access to assessment by making the required trainings more available to people, which seemed really simple. And we started to just do a lot of, this is sort of the walkthrough process, which is not nearly as clean and easy sometimes going through a facility as it is touching base with all of the entities in a state system that might come together to make one training happen. It's always amazing to me how interconnected we are. But we did a lot of work on that. We researched some web-based trainings that were out there. We met with the substance abuse recovery and the human resource development staff, talked about what they were doing, what they felt might be possibilities. We considered partnerships with regional technology centers around our state because we are largely a rural state. We have a couple of large metro areas, but many of our providers are out in rural areas. We considered changing our licensure rules about if they had to be certified prior to that, and could we do a pre-certification, and just we actually thought of lots of different things. We found that some activity was already occurring, and after all of this work, we talked about it and decided, well, you know, why not just make the first change really, really simple and increase the frequency of trainings, just add more trainings. So that made us feel better because that's something that was easy to do. So that with that in mind, we decided that would be our first change. We also updated the training sign-in sheet, the required to sign in at every training. I'm sure that's a real familiar process to all of you. But there was nothing on there about the person's hire date at that point in time. And when we went to go get baseline data, we in fact had to go back to providers and staff members who had received these trainings in the last 6 months and gather hire date, which wasn't too hard. We had a lot of input from our Star SI folks, and they were very helpful. But it was a bit cumbersome, and we hated that added burden to the facilities. So what we did is we added the hire date. So now when each individual walks through the door, they just fill it in for us, and we have it on the training sheet. The next slide shows the baseline data, and the baseline data was run from January 1 through June 30, 2008. And you will see that the number of days that elapsed between someone's new hire date that they provided us with and then receiving ASI and ASAM training was 152 days. So that's a huge time lag. The total number of trainings that were offered in that period were 7 trainings. The total number of staff trained were 317, and the total number of assessments that occurred in that 6 months were 7,100 assessments. So that's all the data that we gathered before we ever made a change. And then we ran the change from July 1 of 2008 through December 30th of 2008. And what we did is the first, you can see on that first results graph there, there were 7 trainings on the baseline 6 months. And for the next 6 months, where we're running our change, we provided 16 ASI ASAM trainings during that point in time, which is a 129% increase in the number of trainings that were offered. Truly, that's just a result of the change that we made. The next one shows the average number of days between hire and that says assessment, but it's actually the average number of days between the hire date of the people who took the training and they're being trained so that they are certified to assess, not their actual first assessment they did, but being certified. And we were actually a little surprised. We expected that number to go down more. It went from 152 days to 127 days on average. So staff completed training an average of 25 days sooner, 16.4% decrease. And I'll talk a little bit more later about why we think that didn't go down even more, even though we more than doubled the trainings that we had available. The next graph shows the total number of staff trained. So during our baseline, we had 317 people trained, and after our change, we had actually 446 people trained. So a 41% increase in the number of staff that went through in that second 6 months, which translates to 129 bodies that now can provide assessment. So that was really a really staggering number when you think about it like that for providers who frequently only have one or two assessment personnel on their staff. And then that last results graph there shows the total number of assessments. We actually have the ability in our service system to pull out the number of assessments that were done in that time frame. We went from the 7,100 assessments done in the previous 6 months to 7,793 assessments were provided in the following 6 months, so a 9.7% increase. And that actually is a 691 more assessments were provided after the increase to training had gone in. So that was kind of amazing to see how many more assessments were being performed. So what are we going to do as next steps? Because we were pleased with the results that we had seen. Clearly it was going the direction that we hoped that it would go. We're going to continue to monitor the data. One of the things that we were a little concerned with was the number of days didn't go down nearly as much as we had hoped. So we did a lot of, again, going back, talking to the customers. We talked to the HRD staff. We talked to provider staff, people who were in the trainings. And what we discovered was people provided hire date. But that really played into a lot of things. The hire date frequently was a lot older than we would have presumed if what we were getting were new staff who were then getting certified to do ASI and ASAM training. And in fact, what we're getting in there are people who may have been hired, let's say, 2 years ago, and they are a beginning counselor. And now they've been promoted to a position or they have enough experience that what they're wanting to do now or what their facility is wanting them to do is to start doing assessments. So they make the decision they want them to do assessments. They may have gotten them into training 30 or 60 days later, but their hire date is showing about a two-year time lag. So that explains some of why we didn't see the number of days between hire date and training date go down quite as dramatically as we had hoped. The other thing that was really great information to find out that we found out talking to our HRD staff is lots of people are taking this again. It's not necessarily that they come and do it once, but that people are brushing up on their skills or people are looking for continuing education credits, and it is something that they do, so they went ahead and went through the training again. So there again, we thought that we'd have this really great measure by looking at hire date versus when they came in, when in fact that's a much muddier measure than we had previously hoped that it would be. Even though it went in the right direction, it didn't drop as dramatically as we thought it would, and once we looked into that quite a bit, we could figure out why. So we're going to continue to monitor the data. We want to make sure that it all continues to at least maintain where we are, if not drop. What we don't want is to start hearing complaints again from the field that we have people who have been on a wait list for training for 30 days, 60 days. We actually had people who had been on a wait list for 4 or 5 months at one point. So we have no wait list. There's nobody currently out there waiting that can't get into a training they would want to, and that's really what we want to kind of focus on there. We're also researching some web-based options for ASAM. After lots of discussions with clinical staff, both in our facilities and at both in our agency and at our facilities, we opted not to go with any sort of web-based addiction severity training at this time. I know the Addiction Severity Index has got some stuff out there, but we're not going to do that. However, the ASAM really seemed to lend itself to training in more of the technology-based kind of training. So we're looking into that.
2 minutes, Michelle.
Uh-huh.
2 minutes.
Thank you. So what was the impact? I've talked a lot about the lessons learned already that we have, but we also did some business case stuff to help providers understand what the change that we made could potentially mean to their business. When we looked at the revenue earning potential, this potential per clinician, it's calculated as 18 days, and it's 18 because we actually lowered the number of days by 25. In other words, they were able to provide assessments 25 days earlier. But if you take out weekends, that comes to about 18 business days. So 18 business days times 2 assessments per day, because we pulled the data and the assessments were really about 2.7 assessments per day that were provided, so we rounded that down just to be on the conservative side, times $240 per assessment. For every clinician that went through the training after we had sped up the training cycle, they had the potential to earn $8,640 more dollars doing assessments for their facility. So we thought that was a pretty decent return on the dollar for increasing the number of assessments that we did. And we did that one because we wanted facilities to understand the change that we had made and the impact it was having on their revenue. And then the other one that you can actually look at is we looked at the actual increase in revenue that was actually received from assessments during that period. So there were 691 more assessments performed and times $240 per assessment. So statewide, we paid out $165,840 more to providers for assessments than we would have had we not been able to get people through that training as quickly as we did. So we really hope that that had the kind of business impact for our providers that they were looking for, and because we sure didn't like the fact that we were hurting their business and keeping people from coming through the door when they didn't have the staff they needed to do assessments. So that was our project. Any questions? All right.
Great job, Michelle. So does anybody have questions or comments for the Oklahoma Change Project? One thing that came to my mind, Michelle, was have you been sort of systematically reviewing the provider agencies, or has it just sort of been word of mouth that they've sort of passed along their appreciation for the more rapid access?
Yeah, we haven't done any formal survey of that yet. So, and we kind of, there's a couple of times a year that we do a poll, and actually that's a great suggestion. I might think about doing it a little more formally this time around to see if we can get some feedback. So I'll consider doing that.
And then the, both your and Lonnie's change projects here involved other parts of the larger department. Is that, you think that's something that's been sort of accepted? What was the struggle in sort of getting the HRD folks involved?
Wow. So there's a can of worms that you're looking into, but let me just give a brief answer to that. David Harris, who just did all the legwork on this project and was awesome, I think he got a good work experience understanding what it's like when you make system change. He came to me one day and he said, I had no idea one such small change could affect so many people and cause such a stir. You know, it's people's business, whether it's the business of HRD and training people or the business of assessing people or what have you. People get really sensitive when you are making change that affects them. He spent a lot of his time talking with people and going back and talking again and asking for input and telling them what we were doing and explaining it to them and showing them results. And so, yeah, it's a real challenge. And when you consider that this is a very small change and how challenging it was, it presents a change, a real challenge every time for states to make change. And I think it's helpful to me to have more people experiencing doing that so that we do get better at working together to make that change, and that if we're not making change together that helps providers and helps consumers, then we're really not doing our job anyway. So I think it was a great experience for everybody, and we're hoping the next time around that it's just that much easier because people kind of know it's a good thing.
Yeah, I wanted to jump in just say real quickly, too, that since all this, two of the bureau chief and one of the licensure surveyors have gone through Change Leader Academy.
Woo-hoo!
They're recognizing the value of it for sure.
Congrats.
So that's actually very exciting, I think.
Yes.
Great. Yeah, that's incredibly valuable insight as well, too, Michelle, that, you know, the exposure to other folks to doing this, you know, takes work, et cetera, but the pace of doing change at the system level is certainly a little bit slower than provider agencies.
True.
Great, okay. Super. Any last quick questions for Oklahoma? Because then we have Florida as the next report out. Sheila and Polly, are you ready to tell your story?
Okay, the focus of what I was going to talk about today is a little bit different than a state change process, but talking about is how we plan to and how we've actually improved our capacity to engage in performance improvement. Because when we apply for the STAR grant and we're looking at our substance abuse system of care, we recognized a need to take a more systemic look and approach to how we did business But across the state, we had pockets of expertise in some areas. And I did send a PowerPoint out. If any of you at your desk, you may can follow along. But anyway, there were pockets of expertise around the state, and some areas were highly trained and can do quite elaborate analyses of the processes and those drivers and things like that. Others had no ability to do that. Sometimes the lack of ability was driven by absence of staff or inability to access and utilize the data that we had for decision making. So one of the key things we wanted to do at the state level with the STAR grant was to establish a basic level of capacity across the whole state to engage in performance improvement. We decided to take a geographic kind of approach. This is a large state, and early on we decided to arrange those around our managing entities, which are, in a sense, networks of providers together under one umbrella. We wanted to increase staff capacity to utilize rapid cycle improvement. We wanted to make sure that we engaged local state staff as well as our provider staff. We wanted to use the managing entities and our state coaches at this point as a hub for performance improvement, so that we would, in essence, have four different areas across the state that had full capacity to engage in performance improvement. We wanted to integrate a cadre of well-trained state coaches and peer mentors that would assist agencies in implementing performance improvement. And we wanted to connect what was going on at the ground level with established improvement and oversight processes at the state and local levels. And as a parallel activity, we also wanted to improve our data capacity to determine client outcomes and to link those activities that happen at the client level that improve client outcomes to those outcome measures looked at by the state. The way we went about establishing the capacity was, as a hub, we started with our managing entities. We had four at the beginning of this project. Now we have three. Since we started our process with STAR, our program with STAR, our state has also rearranged. At first, we were in a district as a local level structure, which then expanded to a larger regional area as we changed governors and our department changed. But we wanted to, at any rate, establish through the managing entities the ability to serve as coaches, have change team leaders trained to a basic level, peer mentors that provided a more advanced service to provider agencies, change team leaders that were trained in using the application, members that had, you know, at least a basic PDSA 101 ability, and we also used the action campaign to bring on capacity at the provider level for those agencies that were very interested, but didn't feel like they were ready for the STAR. So just, it's somewhat repetitive, but basically we wanted to establish a basic level of staff who had the knowledge, skills, and abilities to apply performance improvement techniques to their daily business and improve our system of care. As we've evolved into our third year, we've expanded our managing entities. Not all agencies within our states are members of the managing entities, so we've attempted to have trained state-level coaches in various areas, some of which are housed within the managing entities and some are outside of those managing entities who can also provide assistance to those agencies that aren't members. But we see the state coaches being able to recruit and train other peer mentors, recruiting agencies to practice performance improvement, to work as a liaison between the department and the managing entities as well as the participating agencies, and to also provide some oversight and implementation for future Change Leader Academy and ongoing training with the state, and also to serve as an advisory group to the state offices at the local levels and at our headquarters level. These coaches will serve a pivotal point for this geographic approach, in that you would have coaches with the same core abilities who have had the advanced training who can reach out in their entire geographic area and help to network and bring the other folks together to solve issues. Our managing entities have been involved in developing the performance improvement capacity at their levels and their management levels. That we frequently have key staff that are trained as peer mentors, change team leaders, and in one of our eight entities, one person is trained to the coach level. Within that particular area, within that umbrella, they provide technical assistance to their own agencies, coordinate local education regarding performance improvement and utilization, and disseminate best practices within their network. They also, part of their functions has evolved to integrate their improvement activities within their network across all agencies, and at the local state level, integrate with that framework of improvement so that everyone essentially is working off the same level of planning. Our peer mentors provide technical assistance to the sites. We are using a tiered approach with increasing levels of expertise with peer mentors. Our first year peer mentors are really at nearly the coaching level with these agencies that were in the STAR year one. Then we have our year one and two provider agencies who have continued to be trained and are integrated by having monthly meet-me calls and are working with other agencies. One important aspect of this is that we are working on developing a standardized approach for the peer mentors and the coaches, and we're also working at developing a network of expertise so that we have peer mentors in areas of the state with varying levels of expertise. We have specialty areas, and we are networked to such a degree that if agencies are requesting technical assistance through the peer mentor ongoing call, we're able to match the agency up with a peer mentor that has comparable skills or, you know, particular expertise in the area that they need to provide assistance. If you're able to look at it, I included a state map. And if you can see that, you can see with the red flags the locations of our managing entities. And then with the light blue stars, you can see where we have strategically at least four coaches. We plan, if we are able to access Coaching Academy again, to try to get at least two more coaches trained. And then around those same managing entities, we have particularly trained peer mentors, and we have change team leaders, and we are connected to the managing entities. We are looking at dividing the state roughly for around the coaches in four different quadrants, so that within any of those quadrants that we would have the capacity to bring agencies along, practice performance improvement, and provide technical assistance as needed. Now, the way we're looking at coordinating this would be pulling it together through our Florida Learning System. This learning system evolved out of the STAR Advisory Committee requirement. We have established a charter for our learning system. We have membership that's representational of state offices, provider agencies, the provider association, and higher level educational, you know, colleges. We also include representatives from prevention. So many of the activities that you see, this provides the umbrella for the network of coaches and managing entity staff, peer mentors, and change team leaders. Hello? And then, you know, the last couple of things is that the learning system has an express mission to improve the quality of services at all levels, with the vision of the state becoming vision to provide leadership and direction in the development of a comprehensive system of care that is based on true quality improvement. Establish a learning community that assimilates information, identifies key trends, and implements systemic initiatives that move the entire system forward. The capacity building that I've described and portrayed in these slides are a real key component of our sustainability plan to sustain our gains through STAR. and the learning system itself provides the oversight and directional group to help us continue to establish and maintain that capacity. In the future, areas of focus for the learning system will be to help increase client access to services, improve the quality of those services. We have our special state initiative around the detox to other services and other qualitative activities such as client assessment, screening, and retention. And again, this capacity building has been developed with the state goal of establishing a substance abuse system of care that's based on continuous performance improvement. Thank you.
Great, thanks, Sheila. So any comments from folks? So Sheila, I guess my curiosity here is, what's the evaluation sort of metrics to determine the capacity?
The evaluation metrics would be the increased number in staff that have the training, the competency at those particular levels, coaching level, change team leader level, peer mentor level. We've initiated a particular training for peer mentors. So we have criteria built around that. So that would be one of our metrics. The other metric is really a very simple one, is the number of staff that have the capacity now compared to having the capacity earlier. You know, like I said earlier, we had pockets of a few highly trained staff, but then a large state with not much uniform ability. And what we're looking for is that as we wrap up and move on, that at any part of the state, or at any agency, that if we're talking about performance improvement and rapid cycle improvement, that we have some capacity there to establish a change and implement changes around a need.
Right. And so
metrics would be great too.
So I'm thinking just of the worry or what you've seen, I guess, 2.5 years into this with the original agencies and their willingness to continue to peer mentor, beyond the StarSide project, because being a peer mentor for 1 or 2 years while the project is still fresh and warm is one thing, extending peer mentor services and accessibility beyond the official grant program may be another. Have you started to hear responses on that, or?
Well, yeah, actually, we address that in two categories. We have an ongoing managing entity call where our managing entity staff talk, and they all agree that that's one of their core functions that they need to help create and continue. And on their own, they have continued to train and encourage people to work as peer mentors. The other thing I see is that, and a lot of it has to do, I think, with our evolving relationships with one another and developing those levels of trust, but we have now the managing entity call and our peer mentor call, which are very much self-sustaining, that this group of people take the time to call in every single month. They talk about, if no one is there to specifically guide the call, someone takes over the call. They talk about what needs to be done, talk about their respective agencies that they're mentoring, and agree upon a plan. And they also refer out and send out assignments to people who need to do things. So, those kind of things, when they're initiating themselves, I see is having more staying power. If the state didn't open the line and nothing happened, then I would be worried. But the group takes a lot of pride about it. And this year, our coaches and our managing entity staff have really stepped up to the sustainability and are talking about ways like providing the ongoing training and doing a change leader academy and how they can be leaders in making that happen after the grant. So I think that by this time the work is kind of speaking for itself, that the agencies that have engaged have seen it as working and are good PR for it. We're even seeing at this point in time other agencies that did not get into STAR or even in state areas start to approach us for technical assistance.
Very, very cool.
May I ask a question, Mark?
You bet.
So, Sherry, I was noticing that your state coaches, you know, the recruiting and training peer mentors, did you say you had a training program for peer mentors that they did?
Yeah, we have. We've done we've actually tried a couple of different things, but we actually have a curriculum and a format. Not everyone who is ever a change team leader may want to become a peer mentor,
yeah.
But if you are interested in, you know, the basic thing is the interest, understanding of the data, and ability to teach others.
I'd be real interested in seeing your curriculum if you wouldn't mind sharing.
Okay. I'll be happy to. And one thing I would say that we found that they particularly liked was kind of more of role-playing. What are the kind of questions you get as a peer mentor? And how would you approach this, you know, and how do you work with an executive sponsor compared to a change team leader? So we have a lot of scenarios kind of built that they use to, and that way that helps keep the more advanced peer mentors engaged with those that are just coming on board as well.
Right, yeah. And I would say that's a big challenge because we have some peer mentors that, you know, you don't need to do anything with them. They know what to do.
Exactly. We've got peer mentors that are coaches.
Yeah, bring some of the others along, I guess.
Exactly. So that kind of format really helped the older or the more experienced peer mentors bring more to the group without becoming bored.
Great.
I
would love to see it. If you wouldn't mind sending that to Beth and she could share it with folks, that'd be great.
Sure thing.
Thanks.
And I'll send you our agendas for our meeting.
Okay. Fantastic.
Great.
Any other thoughts or comments on the Florida learning system? Great. Well, good work. I appreciate that, Sheila. Okay, so there we go. We've stepped through now Iowa, Oklahoma, and Florida stories. Really good stuff. Again, I think unique projects, good quality reporting in stories here, and hopefully, again, you have a advance now on the semiannual report with having walked through this and starting to hear from others what are some of the impactful things and angles that they're taking in their change projects and across their STAR-SI implementation as well. So we'll continue to have the remaining three states report out at the May call, and in the interim, of course, in case you've forgotten, Lonnie, the semiannual reports are due on April 30th.
Thanks for the reminder, Mark. I again slipped my mind.
Any final comments from folks?
Good to hear about other states' projects.
Yeah.
It is. It's very interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yep. The really appreciate folks doing the PowerPoints as well. It really helps, keep things in mind as we're going through these. And so I really really appreciate that and great job on it by everyone on that. So with that, I really appreciate everybody's time and hope you have a great rest of the week. And we'll talk to you soon.
Happy Easter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.